back to the Power Hour podcast. Today, I am joined by a track and field athlete, Team GB sprinter and hurdler, Lena Nielsen. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
Well, I say welcome back because the last time we did the podcast, it was actually nearly 4 years ago.
No.
Yeah, it was January 2019.
Oh my God, that is almost 4 years ago. I forget we're almost at 2023. Where's the time gone?
Yeah, and it was a conversation with yourself and with your twin sister, yeah. Lavia. So there was three of us recording. And for anyone who, I mean, it's such a long time ago, but I encourage you to scroll back through the episodes and find that episode. It was brilliant. And of course, you know me, I'm always in awe of athletes and the dedication, the commitment, just the mindset, the physical, all of it. I am just a fangirl when it comes to athletes. And then since then, of course, 4 years, so much has happened in that time.
Yeah, honestly, when you say 4 years ago, I'm thinking 2019, just it doesn't seem that long ago. But then when I look at everything that's happened, it's such a lifetime ago. And it was a good conversation because I remember we spoke about imposter syndrome. And like, it's something that I think a lot of athletes and even venturing to other business ventures, like we all, I think, deal with imposter syndrome a lot. So that was a good conversation. Mm. Hope we can have another good one.
yeah, oh, sure. And yeah, imposter syndrome, I remember us discussing that. And also, I think some people might be surprised when they hear athletes who they see as just having this stature and this power. And they're sometimes surprised to hear that those people are insecure or lack self-confidence. And mm-hmm. I know that many athletes do lack self-confidence, whether it's in their performance or whether it's in, you know, other aspects of their life. And I think, yeah, often people are surprised to hear that when they look up to people, they almost idolize them, put them on a pedestal and think that they don't have those same challenges that everyone else has.
Yeah, I always like to look at it when I look at sports people, myself included, I look at the sports person and the human. And I think a lot of people forget that there's a human side to athletes, because it's what we show. And I think we're partly at fault at this with Instagram and sometimes YouTube and post-race interviews, we show like one side, but then actually there's so many layers when it comes to a human being and then like showing yourself or putting yourself out there on a big stage. Like, we deal with so much, and I think not a lot of people realize how much athletes actually end up dealing with behind closed doors.
Well, honestly, there's so many things that I'm going to talk to you about, but that was one of the things I was going to come on to later, so maybe we'll just start there, as you've, you know, articulated it so well, because I think being an athlete is, of course, what you're known for. Mm-hmm. And often when we are known for something, it does become our identity. Mm-hmm. And that can be for anybody, a teacher, an actor, a professor, an athlete. That word, it can, yeah, define you, who you are. But of course, as you just said, we are humans. We are multifaceted. We are complex. And sometimes diminishing or reducing that to one word, it's very limiting. And of course, then we only show or we only see a limited version of mm-hmm. that person. So yeah, how have you, because you're so young as well, you are so young, I forget sometimes how young you are, but you've been doing athletics for such a long time that I guess you've probably always had, for as long as you can remember, the word athlete next to your name.
Yeah.
So yeah, how have you, I suppose, approached this, thought about this, how do you continue to navigate this dual identity of Lena the athlete and Lena the whole human?
Yeah, do you know what, it's such a difficult line to like make sure you don't cross, because you'll hear a lot of people say, you know, being an athlete is a lifestyle. So yeah, we train for 4 or 5 hours a day, and then everything else we do is accustomed to that lifestyle. So how are you going to fuel yourself or recover, making sure you make the right decision? So I would often miss like friends' birthday parties, because a lot of my friends' birthday parties were in the summer and we compete in the summer. And so you actually end up like just encapsulating the whole identity. You're like, okay, I'm an athlete, so I can't go to this birthday party, or I can't stay up too late. And then like more going into like, I say, my late 20s, I started to realize actually like the human side is way more important than the athlete side. And even like the summer that I just had, I didn't perform the way I wanted to. And when I look back at it now, it's like so minor, because I've done so much with friends and family and my partner and things like that. So being human is so much more important. And so if you just can separate the two, which is really hard, and I think when you're in the first stages of your career, it's pretty difficult, because you just want more and more and more. You just want to win. You want to be the best athlete you can be. And then you forget that actually there's another human that you need to take care of. And I think I was, neglecting that human side for a long time. And only now am I really connecting to her and giving her what she needs. So it is a fine line, and you really have to sit yourself down and think, how am I going to split my week up to make sure I give both of those people what they need. And I only really have understood that the going into 2023. 27 now.
Wow. Well, and also even when you said it then, her, it's that second, it's that third person idea. And almost, are you familiar with Tom, is it Tom Herman? I think it's Tom Herman, his book, which is The Alter Ego Effect. And that talks about essentially how you can create an alter ego for yourself and how that can be a positive thing. So mm-hmm. using this word, I'm an athlete, or I'm a musician, or I'm a teacher, or you can almost build this alter ego or this other identity that you can become and almost turn on and turn off.
Yeah.
And he works with a lot of athletes actually, and he says that often he'll give them a totem or something that reminds them to turn it on and off. So it could be, it sounds silly, but it could be something as simple as when I put on these glasses, or when I put on this necklace, or when I tie on these shoes, I become this version of myself. And maybe that version needs to be ultra competitive, focused, driven, ruthless in the pursuit, whatever you want it to be. But then when you take those things off, you might be a mother, a sister, a friend. Yeah. You might be a different person. And actually, that some, I don't know, I've heard arguments for and against, because on the one hand it's like, okay, yeah, we're the whole and we can't separate the two, but other people say that it's actually incredibly useful and helpful for athletes, but also for everyday people to know that you can step into this version of yourself when you need to, mm-hmm. but you can turn it off as well.
Yeah, and one of my favorite quotes is actually from a ex-athlete who retired quite early in terms of like sports people. I think he retired in his late 20s, and he once said on the BBC, a happy athlete is a fast athlete. And it was because he gave more time to his human side. And a lot of people say your personal life reflects on your like sporting life, because if you're not happy, if you're not in a good place mentally, you are not going to perform. And I think it goes in like your business life, or like, remember when you go to school, or your mum's just told you off the morning of school day, and you go to school and you're miserable, you don't want to do the work and things like that. Like, it does affect your personal life, does affect your, I guess, professional life, whether that be sports or you're in school or you've got a business. And so if you're not giving that person, that human, the nourishing and the love and what you need to do to be happy, it's not going to be good for the sports side or the athlete side, or where the other side is for you as a person. So I think it's so, so important. And I think that's the reason why I had such a good year this past year in my season, before the summer, is because I was a happy person. And actually, I was speaking to my sports psychologist early on before my season, and I'm a yoga teacher, as you know, yoga instructor, and that's a massive part of me as well. And I was talking to him, and I was like, you know, I was away, I was training in the States, so I lost all my studio classes, I wasn't working at Fit that much, because I obviously teach yoga on that as well. And I was speaking to him about yoga, and I was like, I miss teaching, I miss that studio aspect of like seeing your regular clients. And he said to me, you should have seen how much your face lit up as you spoke about yoga. And he was like, I want you to really feed that person, so take yourself to a yoga studio. I was in a really small town in Florida, like really tiny suburban town, and I was like, there's not going to be any yoga studios here. And he was like, just go find one and go take yourself to a class, or even ask the owner if you can teach one. I was like, they're not going to let me teach one. But I took his advice and I went to a class, and then I told him my next session. I had like weekly sessions with him, and he said, did you go to yoga class? I said, yeah, I did. And he was like, I can tell, because you look so much happier, your shoulders are you know, relaxed. And I think that just goes to show how much you should feed all the other parts that make you human.
Oh my gosh. Well, I've got a big smile on my face. I'm literally just, when you said about happiness, because I think when we look at performance, well-being, and just performance in general, so whether that's looking at the physical, the mental, I think the biggest overlook is the emotion, the happiness, mm-hmm. the joy. Because as you just said, you know, if someone says, okay, as an elite athlete, let's focus on mindset, let's focus on performance, the physical training, your nutrition, your sleep, your rest, all of these pieces that come together to create optimum performance, or performance well-being as I call it. But the happiness and the joy part, the fuel and the kind of vibrancy, I suppose, the kind of energy, and the, you know, we've both had a joyful year. You know, we've both had a lot of joy. And it's just that I honestly think it's the thing that I've overlooked that previously in my life. I know other people that do. And I think the misconception is that if you focus on happiness and joy, you won't have the discipline, the determination, and the focus.
Yeah.
I think they're put at opposite ends of the scale, especially in elite sports. So even hearing you and seeing that smile on your face when you're like, I needed to do things to feed my joy and happiness, that is going to help me perform better. It's not one or the other.
It's true, yeah. And it's so important to know that, like, you should also enjoy your job. You know, like, a lot of people think it's all go, 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 you know, don't eat. A lot of people ask me, how is your diet? Like, are you really strict? I'm like, no, I'm not. If I want a chocolate bar, I'm going to have a chocolate bar. If I want a glass of red wine, I'm going to have a glass of red wine, because that's actually one of the best ways to release dopamine in your bodies, to enjoy food. And so when people say, oh, I have a strict diet, I eat boiled chicken and rice, or rice cakes and fish. And I'm like, are you enjoying that? Are you really enjoying that? And then it's like, with, I guess I'm just talking about elite sport, but a lot of people think it's strict, 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 be regimented and do this and do that. And actually, like, for a lot of athletes, and you can go talk to any athlete, that doesn't always work for people. And it's because they're miserable, and then you start to lose the motivation and the joy, and you need passion to drive you in these things, and people forget about that. So always find a way to enjoy. And I always say to people who ask me, how do I get into track and field, or how do I get into elite sport? And I go with a friend, like, take a friend with you, because you need to enjoy it. And so when I get Instagram DMs from young athletes and they go, how do I get faster? How do I do this? I'm like, honestly, at the stage that you're in, just enjoy it. Just go to the track and run for fun. Like, there's nothing, you're not going to get anything by, you know, restricting your diet and making sure you cut out sugar and this, that and the other. So I think where you said, you know, people think there's enjoyment on one side and then there's business on the other side, actually they're quite a lot closer in the spectrum than people think.
Yeah, I'm finding it out too. The joy is fueling my life. So since you were last on the show, it was 4 years, a lot has happened in that time. Mm-hmm. Ups and downs, and you mentioned then you've become a qualified yoga instructor and a trainer on the Fit app. Yes. Shout out to the Fit fam. And you also, I mean, how have we not, where we should have started with the 400 meter hurdles at the 2021 European Championships.
Oh my god, I forgot about that.
Well, just casually forgot she's the European champion. So, you know, incredible, incredible highs. And then more recently, you've shared with the press that you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis almost 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this is an illness that affects nerve cells and can present in a number of different ways. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't even begin to imagine just navigating that last 10 years. So being on the world stage, as you said, the pressure maybe that you put on yourself or that others put on you, mm-hmm. the physical, as I say, I don't know that much about multiple sclerosis, but you know how it can present, and then the mental and emotional side of being given a diagnosis, and on top of that, not being able to share it. So so much in there. Yeah. So yeah, where to begin, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you say 10 years, it's like, yeah, I got diagnosed, yeah, almost 10 years ago. And one of the first things I remember saying was, I don't want this to define me. And I was so young, I was 17. Actually, I got diagnosed a month before my 18th birthday. So processing all of that, I'd say I was 18. And I remember saying to myself two things when I was going through that relapse. So what had happened was I was completely paralyzed on the right side of my body. So I couldn't really move my right leg or my right arm, and that meant I couldn't walk because...
And did this come on out of nowhere? So you just, until that point, you'd not had any signs or symptoms, but you just wake up and you had a paralyzed side of your body?
So it was, so I had two relapses before that, but we didn't know what it was. So I was 13 when I had my first one, and it was my left arm was weak, and the doctors didn't really know what was going on. And you know, being a child, you don't really know how to explain things. And I was going through puberty as well, so I was going through a lot of changes in my body. So I thought it was normal. I thought everyone goes through this. Being 13, you're so naive. And I remember telling one of the nurses, oh, I can move my left arm, but I can't move my left arm, because there was like a slight bit of movement, but not strong movement. It's always really hard to kind of explain what relapses are. And so the nurses and doctors didn't believe me. One of them actually said I was doing it to get out of school. And I love school. So wow. that hit me in like the place that hurt most. I was like, what do you mean I love school? So that was the first one. And then 6 months before I had the paralysis on the right side, I had double vision. And again, that was really strange. And it only lasted about 4 or 5 days and then it went away. But when I had that right side of paralysis, it kind of came on gradually. So it was like I was doing my A-levels, and I noticed that I couldn't really hold the pen properly, and then it progressed to not being able to form a fist, and then not being able to lift my right arm, and then, so it was like really gradual, but it happened within like a week. And so the doctors were really scared because it was such a quick progression, and then I was hospitalized for a week or so. And then I remember like being in hospital bed and thinking, this isn't going to be for nothing, I'm going to make something of this. And I remember the doctors going, you know, you need to go on medication. And I was like, nope, I'm going to recover. And I was only 17. I don't know where I found the strength, because when I look back at it, I'm like, what was I thinking? They were like, you know, you need to take anti-inflammatories. And I was like, nope, I'm fine. I'm going to recover. Wow. And I was so sure of myself. And this is why I believe so strongly in the power of the mind, because I was so sure I was going to recover. And I don't know why I knew that, but I was so sure of it. And so I told them to dismiss me. And then they were like, yeah, fine. Mum can take you home. And it took me about 6 weeks to recover from that. But yeah, I was like, yep. going to go back to track and field. I'm going to be a superstar. 17, I was like, I'm going to take over the world. And I just remember saying, this isn't going to be for nothing. But then also, I'm not going to publicize this. I mean, I wasn't an athlete back then. I wasn't thinking about being a pro athlete, which no one thinks they are at 17. But I remember thinking, like, I'm going to try and make the national championships, which for me now, I'm like, everyone makes the national championships. But back then, it was such a big thing for me to do that and to qualify for the national championships. And I said, I don't want to publicize it because I don't want to be known as the athlete with MS. Like, I just want to be known as that fast 400 meter runner, that fast four hurdler now. So I just remember that being my ethos from back then. And so I was really strict with myself. And I always think back to my 17-year-old like girl, the 17-year-old person, and I always talk to her and I go, I'm doing this for you, I'm doing this for you. So for a long time, I didn't want to publicize it. But then in the summer, I qualified for the World Championships, it being my first World Championships at 26. It took me ages to qualify. It was the day before and I had right-sided weakness and left-sided numbness, and it was the first time it had affected me publicly. So obviously before that I was an up-and-coming athlete, you know, I won the European team champs last year. And so I thought, some people might know who I am, some people might be watching my race, and if you do watch that race, you'll notice my body isn't moving correctly. And you know, I faltered after hurdle five, I just slowed all the way down. And I think to me it was like, okay, maybe now's the time to maybe share what is going on and behind the scenes. And I really thought it was just going to be an explanation as to what happened at the World Champs. I didn't expect so many people to take an interest in it because my Instagram blew up, my Twitter blew up, everything. I had all these requests from different newspapers and I was like, okay, right, this actually might be a big deal. And I didn't realize. And yeah, and it's just been such a whirlwind journey since then.
Yeah, well, I want to loop back if we can. So you mentioned, you know, being 17 and having this mindset, this approach. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, you know, I often say that about things. I'll be like, I had no idea. But this faith, this blind faith, where you said to the doctors, listen, it's cool, I'm gonna recover, I'm gonna be back on the track and training. And as you know, the mind is so powerful. And you know, I wanted to talk to you actually a little bit about the nocebo effect. Are you familiar with this?
The nocebo effect?
Yeah.
No.
So the nocebo effect, for anyone who is not familiar with this, is essentially the placebo effect in reverse.
Okay.
So you know the placebo effect?
Yes.
So the placebo effect essentially is, if I gave somebody a drink of water, and we've all seen Space Jam, and if I told them that this was an amazing elixir of electrolytes and caffeine and different things that was going to enhance their performance, drink this drink and now go and do your run, and then ask them afterwards, how did it feel? Did it feel great? Did it work? And people might report, yeah, it felt better. But it would also, it's not just the feeling, it would actually enhance their performance. So the physiological changes in the body, they might run faster, they might report feeling less tired. And then you could tell them maybe a week later, by the way, that was only water. But the knowledge that they thought they were having something else really does impact the body. So the nocebo effect is the reverse of that. So it essentially says that a negative expectation can cause negative effects. So for example, if you said to somebody, if you gave them a Tic Tac, told them it was a tablet, and said, oh, 9 out of 10 people that take this tablet are going to feel nausea, just to let you know, you might feel nausea. 9 out of 10 people will probably then experience the feeling of nausea. And again, it's not just the feeling that it, because you've planted the seed in their mind, they actually will present with physiological symptoms in the body because of this nocebo effect. So it's exactly works both ways. Now, this got me thinking, where am I going with this? It got me thinking about the fact that you were given that diagnosis as a young athlete and as a young woman, and then that could have gone either way for you. So you had this fortitude to say, no, this is not going to define me. I'm going to go out onto that track. I'm not going to tell people that I have this diagnosis because I'm going to persevere. And if you'd have, I suppose, got taken it the other way and said, well, what does this mean? What does MS mean? Mm-hmm. How is this going to affect me? What can I or can't I do? Mm-hmm. You may have adopted some, I suppose, like limiting beliefs or an expectation, or others might have limited what they believed was possible for you, and that could have really held you back. So it's a, it seems very, I don't know, if at the time, as you said, you weren't aware of this, but what other people around you kind of saying, hold on, like trying to explain to you, this is what MS could mean.
I remember one doctor saying, because I remember saying, no, I'm not going to take that because it's a drug and I'm an athlete and I can't take drugs. And I said to him, I'm a national 800 meter runner. Back then I wanted to be an 800 meter runner. And in the soul of my souls, I want to be an 800 meter runner, but I'm not. Because I'm not a distance runner, I'm a sprinter. But I said to him, I'm a national 800 meter runner. I'm not going to take that. And he kind of gave me this like sorrow, pitying look, like, I don't think you'll be able to do that. And so when I got diagnosed, it was the same doctor. And I remember him so clearly, grey hair, bright blue eyes, really scary. And he said, you know, you might need to change your lifestyle. And my mum was sat next to me and he was like, you might need to change your lifestyle. You know, you said you run track and I don't think that's going to be possible for you. And I blocked it all out. I blocked all of that out. I said, no. And anyone that knows me knows I see the world through rose-tinted glasses. I'm like the most optimistic, positive, at times really annoying, like, oh guys, but this is great, this is happening. It could be like absolutely chucking it down and I'd be like, oh look how great the puddles look. I'm like one of those people and I just blocked all of that out. So I'm not taking anything negative because I fully believed in myself and I fully believed that I was going to make a full recovery, because even when I had my diagnosis I still wasn't fully recovered. I was still kind of limping, I was getting that movement back, but I remember saying, no, I'm going to go back to the track. And it took me a few months to actually get back on the track after that, and my sister at that point was at the World Junior Championship, so she was miles ahead of me, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to catch her up, I'm going to be at the level that she's at. And so I could have taken what those doctors said and think, oh, they told me I can't be a national athlete, but I had plans to be an international athlete. So I was like, you're not going to stop me doing that. And I almost used it as fuel, because when someone tells me I can't do something, I will will do it. So I remember one of my A-level teachers telling me I'll be lucky if I got a B in chemistry. And I wanted to study chemistry at university and I ended up doing that. And he said, you'll be lucky if you got a B and I got an A star in the end, because he told me I couldn't do it. I said, right, you know what?
That chip on the shoulder. And this is the thing. Yeah. I go back and forwards with this kind of idea that the chip on your shoulder is always a bad thing. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a good thing. I've had those experiences definitely in life where people have rolled their eyes at me and gone, Adrienne, come on, like you can't do, you know, like you said, that teacher who doesn't believe in you or who criticizes you. I mean, who are these people and why are they teachers? But it's the chip on the shoulder, although it doesn't always feel good, in my experience anyway, it doesn't always feel good to be out trying to prove you wrong. Yeah. But it can fuel you and it can be a good thing.
Yeah, it can. And you almost want to prove yourself right. And that's the thing. It's like, okay, well, I have these dreams and aspirations. And if you're going to tell me I can't do it, I'm going to show you that I can. And so you end up spinning it to something so positive. And one of my sports psychologists, I've had three in my career, and the one I have now is like an absolute godsend. My first sports psychologist said to me, all right, don't think of a blue elephant. And it's that nocebo thing that you mentioned. It's like, okay, straight away you think of a blue elephant. And so you've got to take that thing and spin it, right? Think of a grey elephant. So like spin it around to what you actually want to see. And so I spin everything around. And only recently I actually also got told I can't do something in track and field. And I've used that and I've had the most amazing 3 weeks of training, because like someone really important said to me that I can't, you know, do something next year. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to prove you right. I'm going to prove myself right, because it's like time and time again, I get told I can't do something. And I think when I released my MS story, one of the interviewers actually asked me, do you believe that you can make World and Olympic finals? And I was like, I won't be doing this if I didn't think I can make World and Olympic finals. Yeah, I have setbacks and I have so many setbacks. I haven't even spoken about half the relapses I've had to endure, but I would not be doing this if I didn't fully believe in myself. And I think if I wasn't ill at the World Championships, I fully believed I could make that final. And I went into those championships believing I could make that final. And so time and time again, you get told you can't do something. And I always, always, always spin it, because like you can be sad and think negatively of yourself. But at the end of the day, it's like, who is to tell you that you can't do the dreams and aspirations that you've thought of since you were a kid? Like, it's all down to you. And so there's such power in yourself, in your mind. And I think 17-year-old me showed that.
Yeah, well, you continue to. Honestly, you continue to. And you mentioned it then for a second. Oh, my sister. But for anyone who knows you, you have a twin sister. Mm-hmm. I want to say identical twin.
We are identical. Identical. Yeah, we kind of look separate now. We've got different hair colours.
Yeah, an identical twin sister who is also an incredible athlete and who, as you said, has had incredible success. So at that time, when you were having these relapses, you're going through these things, no one really knows, and obviously your sister is on the world stage achieving her dreams and goals. I mean, I can't actually even begin to think, you know, I know you're a positive person and I know you and your sister are incredibly close, but that could have gone either way as well, because you're watching your sister, literally identical, she's like a mirror of you, doing that. And I remember when you were on the show before, I remember you saying to me then, obviously didn't know about this then, but you said, it fuels me because I can see her and I think if she can do it, I can do it too.
So
how did you, I'm sure it's probably difficult when she's not here to speak on her behalf, but it's probably difficult for her as well. Mm-hmm. And you're so close and you're kind of in it together, but she's not having to experience what you are. So yeah, as a twin, how on earth did you manage that?
Yeah, I mean, it was so difficult being a twin because to this day, I still get confused. Like people go, are you Lavi? I'm like, no, I'm not Lavi, I'm Lena. But actually now it's flipped. So people go to her and say, are you Lena? Because for some reason, more and more people are finding out about me. But back then it was like really difficult because it was hard because I knew I could be the same. I could have been the same level. And had I not fallen ill, or had I not, gotten weak at some point, like I would have had the same progression, but I just kept getting, it was like two steps forward, one step back, whereas she was always two steps forward. And so it was really difficult to see the success that I could have had. But then when I kind of went past 18, 19, 20, now 21, when I started to get into my 20s, I started to really stop comparing myself because it was so damaging to see what could have been, you know, what could have happened and what could have, like, even when I look back at my summer, I'm like, I could have made the world final, but it's damaging to think about that. And so I stopped comparing myself and I started looking at myself and what I could have been as an athlete. Mm. And that's actually one of the reasons I switched to the 400 meter hurdles. A lot of people don't realize, like, we both used to run the 400 meters. But I was miles behind. Now we're quite close, actually. Fun fact, our season's best are 0.01 seconds apart.
Wow.
So she's ranked 7th in the UK in the 400, I'm ranked 8th in the UK. And her season's best is 51.53, and I'm 51.54. And I was so upset when she knocked me down the rankings. I was like, oh gosh, why did you knock me down? But back then I was like, all right, I need to do something to make myself an athlete and to have my own story, basically. And I said, I'm gonna give the four hurdles a go, you know. And I had no training, like nothing, and I just blindly entered this open race and ran the four hurdles, and I loved it. And I was starting to like lose joy of the 400 meters, and so I was really like enjoying that journey. And only now I can really say I'm a hurdler, I think, because I spent a long time trying to be a good hurdler. But it was, I think a lot of people are victims of this. I think we compare ourselves to people. Oh, what, like, she's doing this and I want to do that. And then you lose yourself and you lose your own journey. And it took me a long time to actually be okay with my journey. And once I did that, I just became like a whole person in my own right. And it was really freeing, actually. So, but being so close to her, she was the only one for such a long time that knew exactly what I was going through. So whenever I did win a race, she'd cry more than me. So if you look at pictures from when I won, so I came second at the trials this year. Again, no one knew anything. So it was only a month after that did I release my story. But she was crying. Like, she dragged me down to the floor and we were like hugging each other. And that, the photo ended up going Instagram viral. Like, it got like 25,000 likes. I was like, where did these likes come from? Usually I get like 2,000. I was like, where did these likes come from? But it was because you could see the emotion, and only she really understood like the journey. She used to like look after me when I was going through relapses where I couldn't really hold things or like do my hair, and she would be the one to look after me. So she really understood what that meant for me. And so to have someone so close in my circle to really like spur me on, obviously seeing her successes makes me want to also achieve that. So I think we're at such a privilege, and I always say to people, we're at such an advantage because we have each other. And I don't think people really understand how important it is to have such a close support system. And I don't think, if she wasn't in the sport, I don't think I'd be in the sport. And that's believe that. And I think she'd say the same thing.
Well, I think, you know, it's, as we've discussed, many different reasons why it would have been difficult for you to share your story before, but now you have. Now you've spoken and said, you know what, I have this diagnosis and I'm gonna continue to do what I want to do with it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sure you have your reasons for doing that, and I'm sure that a lot of young people who get diagnosed with illnesses, whether that's MS or whether that's diabetes or epilepsy, or, you know, I know when people get a diagnosis in their life, it changes everything, doesn't it? You know, it might change the way you feel about yourself, the way other people feel about you, the way other people treat you. And so I think it must be incredibly powerful for a lot of people, actually, to hear your story, to see you and the optimism and just the energy, and even this conversation, you just have this blind, you know, there's no feeling sorry for yourself. There's no, and I know that's not, I shouldn't really say that, but, you know, often people, they do. It's like, well, now I can't see anything else. I can't see a way out. And like I said, people start to treat you differently. So I think it must be really, really powerful for people, if they have been diagnosed with an illness, to look at someone like you and to say, you know what, maybe I'm not going to be an Olympic athlete, but I'm not going to also allow this to define me. I can continue to achieve my goals or live the life I want to live. And maybe it has to adapt. I'm not going to, pretend. It might definitely have to adapt for some people. but you can find an optimistic and a positive way through.
Yeah, I think especially with something like a mess, like I had a lot of messages on Instagram of a lot of young girls. Like I didn't realize how many young girls actually get diagnosed with this, because I thought I was young when I got diagnosed. I was only 17, but I had a message from a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 21-year-old, like so many messages. And they all said they're so scared to even tell their friends because they think that they're going to be treated differently and discriminated against. Because I think the knowledge that the public have of MS is that it's disability, and then you can't even work a proper job. And for some people with MS, that is the case. But it's such a wide spectrum, and it just presents so differently for so many people. Speaking of my twin, actually, she got diagnosed last year, and she only had like tingling on her left arm, and that led to a diagnosis. And for other people, it's a complete opposite symptom that they're going to have, where it's like they might not even like be able to move their legs. And so I think a lot of people are really scared to kind of talk about diagnosis. And this leads to other like autoimmune conditions. I mean, celiac is another one. Mm. Crohn's disease is another autoimmune condition. There's like so many people deal with these conditions, and we just have no idea. And I think a lot of people didn't have any idea with me because it was such a shock, I think. But I think a lot of people do get scared, and they do get... It is difficult to not be sad. Do you know what I mean? Because it is such a life-changing condition. And don't get me wrong, I was such a sad 18-year-old. I was so sad. I was like, I'm not going to be able to go to the Olympics or, you know, go to the World Championships. And I dealt with that sadness. And then on the other side of that, I was like, you know what? Just make do with what you have. Like, just play with the cards that you've been dealt. I'm probably never going to break a world record. And I'm okay with that. But I'm going to try and make it to the World Championships. So I'm going to try and make it to the Olympic Games. And I was so close last year. but I think it does require people who are dealing with these things to actually put themselves on the public stage and show people the absolute range that you get with conditions like MS and other autoimmune conditions. Like, it can be so different, and I think that's why it's so important to showcase exactly what you're going through, and so that people have something to look up to. Because when I got diagnosed, I wanted someone to look up to. Mm. But I couldn't really find many positive stories, and I found one positive story, and I actually ended up reaching out to her, Kadina Cox. She's a good friend of mine. She actually helped me out. She got diagnosed 2 months after me, so it was so fresh for her. But I remember DMing her on Twitter. I had a BlackBerry back then. I remember DMing her on Twitter and going, I feel really sad, like I don't know if I can do track and field. And she was such a positive beacon for me, and she just said, look, just try and get as far as you can. And I think people like me and Kadina and others in sport and doing, you know, things that we like, I think it gives people that beacon of hope. And I actually got interviewed recently by a very pessimistic journalist, and I had to put him in his place because he was like, you know, what did he say? He said something like, a lot of people think that there can be a cure for MS. And I said, yeah, you know, I think it's positive to think about that, you know, think about the fact that it could be cured one day. And then he said something like, but isn't it damaging to give people that false hope? And I said, I think the more damaging thing is to tell people that they can't do what they want to do. Mm. And it was just like this mic drop silent moment, because I don't think he came across a lot of positive people that have conditions that can be debilitating. And I think it's really important to... That's kind of like the role that I want to have, is to show a positive spin on it. Yeah. And it actually ended up being my purpose. Like, I made it like my... It fuels me to this day. It fuels me to train harder, and it fuels me to be a better person and a better athlete, as we spoke about. It in a weird way, gave me a purpose to life, because I was like, I want to use this and I want to make it something. And this is even way before people knew about it. I was like, yeah, this is going to be something, even if it's just for me, to show myself that I could do it. And so I always tell people, whenever they go through a difficult experience, allow yourself to feel that sadness, but not for too long.
Yeah.
And just spin it and make it a positive thing, because it can be such a powerful drive for you in whatever you're doing in life.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
The The next thing that I want to talk to you about is yoga. We've touched on this. You are a qualified yoga instructor. When I met you, I don't think you had maybe even started this journey then.
Yeah.
And now, of course, you're a yoga instructor on the Fit app. You know, again, we talked about this off mic, but a lot of people probably don't know that I don't work at Fit anymore, but of course
it was a shock to me as well.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't worked at Fit for a while, but my husband, of course, you know, they still have access to me, and I still have so much love for everyone, the team, what they've done, and of course to democratize fitness and for so many people to be able to access, people like you, and to have you there in their living room and to be able to train with you and recover with you and work out with you.
Yeah.
So talk to us about yoga. Why does it bring such a big smile to your face? What does yoga do for you? How did you embark on this journey?
Yeah, you know, so we had our last podcast, was it January, you said, 2019? Yep. So it was actually September that year that I decided to book a first class, I wish, a one-way ticket to India. So I had failed to make the World Championships that year. I think I was a half a second away from the standard that I needed. And so I was so close, but yet so far. And it was heartbreaking for me because that was obviously one of my goals, was to make the World Championships. And I was like really, really close. And I just told myself, you know what, I think I'm done with sport. And I was like, every athlete goes through this where they like have this one dramatic moment in their life where like, I'm going to retire. And then actually they just realised that they just needed a break. So I remember like sitting in my room at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I booked this one-way ticket to India because I wanted to do it properly. Like I really wanted to like experience classic yoga. And I went there to teach myself. And the story I told back then was that I had a stress fracture, which I did, and I had to find other ways to move. But what a lot of people don't know is that I actually had a relapse in the spring. Yeah, which was a loss of coordination. I always tell people like, oh, they're like, what's that like? And I'm like, you know when you go on an escalator that's not working?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
And it's like that weird moment of like, oh, this feels a bit. That's what it feels like to have like a relapse where you lose coordination. So I had a relapse and I couldn't really run properly because one side was weaker and there just wasn't coordination. It was a really strange sensation. It was so weird. I can't even explain it. But I couldn't train properly. And so I did have to find other ways to move. And this was after I had the stress fracture. And then someone told me to go to yoga. I can't remember who it was. I think it was my osteopath. He said, go to a yoga class. It's really great to kind of like keep the nervous system going. And I was like, what? Yoga? Like, that's really weird. But it's kind of like, it's to do with balance and coordination. And so I went to yoga class, hated it.
Really?
Hated it. I was like, what? Why do people do this? Everyone knew the names of the poses. Everyone was blowing into the next pose and I was there so confused. Like, how do people know this? And I went out of that class like thinking, oh, I failed. You know, being a sports person, you want to do everything.
You want to do it the best.
Yeah, to the perfect standard. And I left thinking like, oh man, that was really bad. Like, I'm so bad at yoga. But then I noticed that evening that I was moving better. And it was such a strange feeling. I was like, oh, like I feel connected. It felt like something had rewired in my body.
Wow.
And I realized the power of yoga. And so I took myself to another class, I think 2 days later, and it was a different class. I think it was like dynamic vinyasa or something. And I loved it. And I started to understand. And then that's kind of why I started that yoga journey. And that was in 2017. So I was practicing yoga for 2 years. And then I wanted to go to teach training to teach myself. So to understand a little bit more about the anatomy of your body, to understand all the poses, not all the poses, there's like 20,000 poses, the majority of poses. I wanted to just sequence classes for myself to reconnect myself if a relapse ever happened again. And so people always go, you know, she just became a teacher just for fun. Actually, it was because I didn't want to ever be like weak again. I wanted to always move my body, and so that's kind of the reason I became a teacher. And then I started, when I came back from my teacher training, I was like, oh, I think I can actually teach athletes. And so I was actually working as a gym receptionist back then when I came back. And I remember like going on like the class schedule and like taking a class out and putting my class in. I was like, power yoga with Lena. So I changed the timetable and I started teaching classes, and I realized how much
with
I
permission
love.
No.
Yeah. I spoke to the student manager. I was like, Thursday afternoon, can I take that slot? And he was like, yeah, take it. And I started to get my regular students coming in, and I love teaching in studios. And then the pandemic hit and I was like, oh man, I just started to really like get experience with teaching. And so I took all my classes went down. I think I was teaching like 9 studio classes a week, and it was like 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. And then it moved to Zoom, and I did not like teaching on Zoom because everyone turns their cameras off and then it's like, you can't see them. And I love that interaction. And that's one of the reasons I love teaching yoga, is seeing people like leave the class with a joy in their face. And so then I was like, maybe I'll take it to Instagram Live. And so I went Instagram Live and I put it on my stories, like, guys, I'm going to teach Friday Flow at 4 p.m. on a Friday, expecting maybe 10 or 20 people to show up on the live. And it was like 250 people on my first Instagram. I was like, whoa, this is crazy. And so I taught like a 20-minute class. And then I got all these DMs like, can you teach again next week? And so because we were all in the lockdown, it was like, I did it for 10 weeks straight. And that's actually how I got approached by Fit, was because I was doing Instagram Lives. And I always believe everything happens for a reason. And then I started teaching at Fit and I absolutely loved it. It was like such a positive atmosphere with everyone. Everyone was so passionate about fitness. And I was like, yeah, this is for me. Yeah. And so I think my brand, or like who I am as a person, is movement. Movement for me is such a big thing and it's so important. And even going into like the summer that I had, like, when I had my relapse in, so I was all the way in Eugene for the World Championships, I asked the team members to fly me home as soon as possible, because I told myself I have to move. I have to take myself to classes, because I knew that was the best way to recover from that relapse. Because so what had happened was, it was, I couldn't feel the left side of my body, but it was also right sided weakness, and I knew it would get worse. And it's also the nutrition as well. Food in America is not great. So I told myself, I need to go home and I need to fuel myself and I need to move. I just need to walk my dog or go to yoga class or do something. And that relapse ended up not being so bad. And I think it was because I told myself, you need to start moving and move your body in different ways. So being a yoga teacher for me encapsulates all of that.
Yeah. Well, I think, movement is something we both share a passion for. We both talk about, you know, I talk so much about movement, move your body, and sometimes I feel like a broken record, you know, movement's good for this, movement's good for sleep, movement's good for energy, digestion, cognitive function. What is movement not good for?
Yeah.
And I think for a lot of people, unfortunately, they've just got movement in this box in their head, which says exercise, which says hard work, which says break a sweat, which says don't want to do it. And, you know, you might not know, but I go and I talk to a lot of organizations, to the employees, about performance well-being and about the tools that we can all use, regardless of whether you're a pro athlete or whether you're a tech engineer or whether you work in marketing, whatever. There's these things that we can all do, and movement being one of them. And it is interesting, and sometimes it's quite limiting when people just think, okay, exercise is not for me, movement is not for me. And it's really, really great for people to find these different on-ramps. So whether that is through walking, whether it's through running, whether it's through yoga, whether it's through a fitness app, if there's an on-ramp that that people can use to go, actually, this way of moving my body, what you just said was, I experienced the power of yoga, because for you, as you said, you went and had that class and then later on you're like, hold on, I'm moving better. Now for other people, that might just be, you know, going out for a run or a walk and coming back and going, you know what, my shoulders have dropped. I feel a bit less stressed. I feel a bit better able to cope with the demands of my day. People have to find those on-ramps. And I think whichever way it is, I'm never going to stop talking about the power of movement, because it's we're made to move, right? We are made to move, and our bodies do not want to be sitting still all day.
No, it's so, so important. And that's kind of why, also why I like yoga, because it's so accessible. I always tell people, you can do it on your living room carpet. You don't even need a fancy yoga mat. You don't even need a space. You can literally just put the TV on if you want to, put friends on in the background, and just do it on your living room carpet. And that's why I love about yoga, and also running, because I think Usain Bolt called it the poor man's sport, because all you need is a field. You don't even need a fancy track. And so I love accessible movement, and I think that's why I love yoga. And I teach all kinds of yoga, from yin to power yoga, which is my favorite type of yoga, because it's like so many different types of yoga that you can do, and you don't even need a fancy gym membership or a fancy teacher. You can literally just do sun salutations in your living room. And that's what I love about it. And I sometimes wake up feeling demotivated, and that literally, it's like a flip of a switch. As soon as I walk my dog in the morning and come back, I'm like, wow, whole new person. And that's just because I've walked for 10 or 20 minutes. And it's such like, the power of movement is so good for the mind, just to get that fresh oxygen through the mind, and just to get some space and some air, and movement is just so, so powerful. And I think everyone can benefit from it.
If anyone's listening to this, I had a DM from someone the other day after my weekend long run. My weekend long runs are back. More about that another time, because I'm training again for endurance events, which is great, but also scary.
Don't know how you do it. Yeah.
And so I had a DM from someone who said, Adrienne, I'm injured right now and I'm so down. Movement is my, you know, how we're talking about this. Movement is so great. Movement is medicine. Movement makes you feel great. And she said, I'm so down. I'm so low. I can't find anything else that replaces that feeling of going for a run or being able to train hard. And I think, you know, I don't know this person. I don't know them at all, you know, stranger on Instagram, but she essentially was like, what can I do, or what do you do if you're injured to kind of come out of that? Now, obviously you've talked about having relapses and maybe knowing, okay, it's going to get better, but maybe not knowing how long is it going to take. Mm-hmm. So from a mindset perspective, if you are feeling demotivated, if you are feeling low, if your energy and mood is so attached to physical movement and that identity, if someone's injured and you cannot train, yeah, how do you approach that? Are there any other practical things, any other tools that you've learned over time to say, okay, I can't train right now,
yeah,
I'm going to do this instead?
I feel like I've become a master of it, not being able to train. I mean, so I always, again, put a positive spin on things. So I'm a sprinter. All I do is run very fast. And I don't do much else. And so whenever I've been injured, so when I had my stress fracture, I remember thinking, okay, I can't put any load through my legs. So I couldn't even like go to the gym and do squats, which a lot of people can do if they're like slightly injured. And I remember one thing telling myself was, okay, what weaknesses do I have? And my core was extremely weak back then when I had my fracture. And I thought, okay, I'm going to spend the next, they told me it was going to take like 4 weeks to recover. So I'm going to spend the next 4 weeks redirecting my priorities in fitness to making my core stronger as opposed to getting myself faster. And so I spent so much time finding what are the weaknesses I had and working on that. And so that's when I've had like a fracture and I thought, okay, I'm going to work on my core. And then when I came back to running, you don't even realize how much your core is so important when you run. And then I end up running and feeling so much more stable and so much more like powerful because my core, like everything from my back to my abs and my hip flexors, which also counts as your core, was so strong. And so when I've had relapses, I look at other things that I can work on. And so more recently, when I've had relapses, I actually work on my biggest weakness, which surprisingly is my mind. And so I work on my mind. So I've been like reading books and then visualizing myself on the world stage. And I've been spending a lot of time in the past year doing that. And I think that's why I had such a good season this year, was I worked a lot on my mind and made it a lot stronger. So you have to kind of, obviously nothing can replace the feeling of running fast because it's just the running fast, but you have to almost redirect your focus on what you want from running fast. And you need a strong core, you need a strong mind, you need coordination and balance. So that's another thing I work on when I've had relapses, is work on my balance and coordination. So I'll do the most uncomfortable yoga poses, revolve triangle, revolve half moon, those things. It's like so uncomfortable, but I know it's going to work on my balance and things like that. So I end up just redirecting what it means to run fast and what you need to do that. And so all working on every single tool that you have in your disposal. So I would say to someone who is going through an injury or an illness, is to see what else you can work on in that time, because you hopefully will get back to where you were.
There's something we can be working on, and it feels incredibly frustrating, and I'm an impatient person, so I know myself, you think, oh, 6 weeks, that's so long, or 6 months, but actually the time does pass, and if you can work on those other things, then once that time's passed, you're going to be better off for it.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the power hour. Let's talk about how maybe the power hour's changed, or I'm not going to put words in your mouth, you tell us. So what time does your day typically start, and what do you typically do in the first hour of each day?
Yeah, that's actually a good one actually to lead back to. So last year I was training on the east coast of the States, which is 5 hours behind the UK. So when I first flew over to the States, I woke up at like 4:30 in the morning, because obviously jet lag, and I didn't change that sleep schedule. I made sure that I was waking up at 5:30. It ended up towards the end being 6:30. but I would make sure to wake up early because you can get so much done in the morning. And I didn't realise this, because when I'm in London, I usually train around 10 a.m, which a lot of people are like, oh, I thought elite athletes train early. No, we train at like 10 a.m. So I'd wake up at like 8. But when I was in the States, I was waking up really early, and I'd walk my dog first thing. Walk my dog, because that movement, like get the oxygen flowing through the mind. And then when you're walking your dog, and most of the time I'd go without my phone, is you'd walk the dog, and then when you're walking, it's, I like to call it moving meditation. You start to think about your to-do list, and you start to think about what you need to do today. And I'd make like a mental note of things I wanted to do. And I didn't it was really funny, the group that I was in, we never knew what our session was going to be. You just turn up to the track and then coach would say, you've got so-and-so today. Now I have my program, so I'm a bit prepared for my sessions. But back then I didn't know what my session was going to be. So I'd always prepare myself for the worst. So if I've got...
What's the worst?
Oh my God, like 3 times 300 flat out. Full recovery. It's like the worst. Any track athlete will tell you that's the worst session. So I'd prepare myself for the worst session. I'd go, right, if coach today says you've got race rehearsal, you've got a really fast time trial, you're going to smash it. So I'd always like prepare myself for training. So walk my dog and then I'd go have my coffee when I'm done. And then when I'd sit with my coffee, then I'd write down my to-do list. And then I made sure I would spend an hour working on my mind. And this is why I think now mentally I'm like in such a strong place, is I would read a book or go through my sports psychology notes. My sports psych will always send me assignments. So I go, what assignment has he sent me this week? And I'd work on that, and I'd spend such a long time. And so whenever I had a sports psychology session, he'd go, wow, you've done so much on this, because I spent that first hour of the morning like really working on that.
It's so, almost like you've read the Power Hour book.
It's almost like I listened to the Power Hour podcast. Again, maybe listen to a podcast, like do something to make my mind stronger. And so for me now, you know, going into this latter part of my career, powwow for me means working on the mind. And so, yeah, it's different stages, walk the dog, refresh the mind, wake up, and then really think about your intentions for the day. And that's my big thing, is setting your intentions.
Great. I love it. I love it. This is honestly, because it's all very well, of course, I talk to people for a long time now. Can you imagine how long I have been talking to people about the benefits of early rising, about creating that time to be intentional and taking an hour? And it's almost, I don't want to say it's become dilute, but because I've been doing it and talking about it, I think people sometimes think, yeah, Adrienne, that works for you, you know, it works for you. So it's always great to hear different people's versions. Sometimes, you know, it might be really structured, it might be not so structured, it might be, but to hear for you, I suppose, the impact that it's had, that it continues to have, is what I want people to take away. Not that you have to do this prescribed thing, it's actually just the repetition, I think, and being intentional about having a power hour in the first place. Just that, just saying, okay, I'm going to walk the dog, then write the notes, have my coffee, work on the mind, read the book. Just, you know, the commitment and keep doing it and doing it and doing it. It's, yeah, it's really, really powerful.
Yeah, for sure. And it almost, I love that you say it's like the first hour of your day, because it can change everything. Like I said at the start, like if you had a school day and your mum screamed at you, like the whole day's ruined. So think about that, and then like think about, okay, what am I going to spend the first hour of my day doing? And I love that. And I actually got the inspiration from the Power Hour. It was, okay, right, what am I going to spend my first hour in the morning doing? And so I made it a routine, and it just became something. It was one of my non-negotiables, was work on your mind today, this morning, before you go to training, and absolutely batter yourself on the track.
Wow. Oh, this is making my day. Okay, and the last question, because I thought about this earlier on when we were talking right at the start about the athlete, the title of athlete, and the identity of athlete versus the whole complex self. So Lena, what is one thing that you wish more people knew about you?
Oh, you took me by surprise there. I wish more people knew that.
Take a little break. I'm thinking we can cut it in, because I did just throw that one out there.
Do you know what? I think a lot of people looked at my Instagram and thought, she's a runner, 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 does fitness, fitness, fitness. But actually, I wish more people knew that, how much of like a loving person I am. Like, I absolutely adore my dog, he's like my wallpaper on my phone, love my friends, checking in them, and just love building the relationship that I'm in at the moment. It's just made me such a nice person. So I think a lot of people were surprised at how like okay I was in the summer, is because I had all of that, like that loving part of my life. So I wish
joy
people knew that I was more of a human. I think I want to post more about that on Instagram, because I do post a lot about running. But actually,
oh, please do, please do, we love to see it. And honestly, it's funny, because you know, again, we've talked about the summer and the joy, and this has been the most joyful year of my entire life, as you know. And I felt like that with, you know, how many times can I post photos of my wedding?
I literally said that when I walked, I was like, you're glowing. Like, literally, you can see it on your face.
And I think it's funny, isn't it, these limited versions of ourselves that we share online with the world, whether it's okay, you're an athlete, so show us this, or whether it's you're a motivational speaker or whatever the thing is, we are so much more. We're so complex. And actually, I feel like, for whatever reason, of course, I've got, you know, my son, I've got a blended family, I've got stepchildren, so there's lots of reasons as to why you might share certain things and not other things. That's okay. Yeah. You know, we can have a private life. I'm actually sharing an episode of the podcast soon to celebrate 4 years of Power Hour, which is probably the most personal interview, I suppose, because instead of being the host, I am the guest.
Oh,
yes. So that is coming very, very soon. And so it's fresh in my mind, this idea around, you know, we don't have to share everything of our lives. This weekend being a perfect example. My weekend this weekend was watching my son at football. It was doing homework. It was doing French revision. It was, you know, stepchildren. It was cooking. It was one of them has been, you know, unwell. So it's been, you know, up in the night. It's all these different sides, all this part of your wonderful, colourful, busy life that maybe you don't share, but also doesn't have to. Yeah, we have so many things in our lives and it's great to, we want to see it. So basically, yes, show us more, show us the joy. We want to see the track and we want to see the track star, but we want to see the whole person, the whole Lena.
True.
For as much as you want to share with us. For as much
I'm going to keep that in mind.
Yeah. Well, thank you for coming back.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, it's been wonderful. And I mean, I get to train with you because I do your wonderful classes on the Fit app. So you're a regular in our living room. But I hope to see you again very soon. And thank you everyone for tuning in, for listening as always. I really appreciate it. I hope you're having a fantastic week. And I'll be back again next week with another episode. See ya.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.